And welcome to episode 45 for August 7th, 2007. We're going to get started with a top six list this week. This one is on boat movies, thus completing our whole trifecta of transportation flicks. Planes, trains, and boats? Anyway, we'll have a trivia question from Sam, and after that, we're going to continue our discussions of the career of Alfred Hitchcock with the second part of our director spotlight on him. And even though if you're listening to this podcast, you clearly have some idea how to use a computer, you're probably not an advanced computer user, which is why I'm going to give you the lowdown on my how to use a computer, at least the Hollywood version of it. I'm Stephen Keller.
I'm Sam Stoddard. Did I get here on time? Did I make it?
Yeah, you just... It's a little late, but I just finished the intro.
You won't believe the morning I've had. Let me tell you. On the way to the studio, I was driving along by the Pleasure Garden, you know, the spot right up in the mountains there where it starts going downhill. Got a terrible sense of vertigo up there, but anyway, it's a nice morning. I'm listening to these waltzes from Vienna on the radio, and all of a sudden I see this flashing blue light. So, you know, I look through the rear window, and sure enough, there's this cop pulling me over. I mean, it says squad car number 13, says on the side. Sorry, number 17, my mistake. But anyway, I pull over, and it says license and registration, and I hand him over, and he says, where are you headed? And I say, well, the All Movie Talk studio, you know, next to the Mountain Eagle Lodge and across from the Jamaica Inn. Well, anyway, he says, yeah, likely story. And he looked at me with this intense suspicion, you know. He said, come on, come clean, I'm on to you. And I said, well, I don't know what he's talking about, actually. So I said, fine, I confess, I had a tiny little sip of champagne, but that's it, I'm legal. And he said, don't play games with me, I'm talking about murder. It's like, murder? He said, you know, yeah, a fellow matching your description committed an act of sabotage on the plane back at an embassy. A foreign correspondent named Harry Thornhill was killed. I said, hey, listen, you know, don't work yourself into a frenzy. I'm no saboteur. You think I'd blow up a secret agent? You got the wrong man. I mean, I got nothing to do with your trouble with Harry. Well, anyway, a small, fleeting shadow of a doubt crossed his face, and then it hardened, and he said, you know, how'd you know the guy was a secret agent? You know, you're not as young and innocent as you make out. You're a man who knows too much. So he arrested me. I said, look, I'm due at the studio. You can't arrest me. And he said, you think I don't know how to catch a thief? I said, I thought you were looking for a murderer. And he said, well, the psycho swiped a priceless topaz off the body. That's motive. And I noticed you have a topaz on that cufflink of yours. And I said, I bought that years ago. You can't do this. This is blackmail. Well, sure enough, he took me down to the jail, and it was a terrible, terrible walk down the aisle to my cell, too. I mean, all these prisoners staring, you know, spellbound at me so hard. I mean, it's like a stage fright, practically, you know. I was scared. I mean, you imagine me, a notorious criminal. Anyway, I wasn't in the cell 5 minutes, though, when the bricks in the back wall popped out, and this cool blonde slipped out of a hidden tunnel. She said, I'm Rebecca Marnie, and then the lady, you know, vanished back into the hole. So I followed her through the tunnel to the outside, and, you know, it must have been like, I don't know, 39 steps. And we climbed down this rope into a lifeboat waiting on the shore, and we climbed in. She said, well, I'm going to row us out of here. Put on this ring, and she handed me this wedding band, and she said, if the Coast Guard stops us, we're Mr. and Mrs. Smith. You know, I was a farmer's wife, and you were a lodger we took in. We fell in love. And I said, you know, easy virtue, eh? I mean, that's rich. Rich and strange. How do you think up a family plot like that? Well, she didn't answer. She just took the oars, you know, and started rowing, as I recall, north by northwest under Capricorn and the birds. And anyway, we moored the boat, and she said, well, now get back to the studio and record episode 45. And I said, well, but wait, how will I get in touch with you again? I mean, you know, can I have your phone number? And, well, she just pierced me with her cool gaze and said cryptically, just dial M. I said, you know, M for Marnie? And she just answered with this enigmatic smile and walked away into the rain and the mist and the furthest reaches of my memories.
I'm sorry, I wasn't paying attention. Could you say that again? Where were you? My mind wandered for a second. I was at another call. Go ahead and fill me in again.
That was a long story. I mean, I'd just like to say one thing. Maybe this will sum it up for you. Juno and the Paycock. In the past on this show, we've done train movies and plane movies, and we're going to do boat movies this time because, hey, transportation is fun, and the movies sometimes involve transportation. So my number six boat movie is going to be Mutiny on the Bounty from 1934, kind of an obvious one, but it is a great movie. starring Charles Laughton and Clark Gable, in this great clash of wills that takes place on board a ship. Basically, we have this captain who is just a total nut job and a tyrant and a cruel person, and a guy who stands up to him. A lot of great character drama and some adventure there, and then the fallout afterwards. I love the movie, and over to you, Stephen.
Okay, well, my number six pick is another mutiny film, and it's The Caine Mutiny from 1954 by director Edward Dmytryk. And this is a movie that's really mostly memorable for a stellar performance by Humphrey Bogart as the captain of a ship who we feel has sort of lost his grasp on reality as the movie goes on. He starts off as being this, you know, sort of really stern, hardworking, traditional naval tradition kind of guy who wants discipline and respect. But we start seeing how it goes way too far. And, you know, there are some kind of weird things about this movie. I think it's a little uneven at parts, and there's this kind of crappy romance story in there. But, man, this is one of Bogart's just most compelling, powerful performances. A lot of it takes place actually off the boat in a courtroom as we sort of have this whole frame structure in which the ship's officers are being charged with mutiny. But there's a lot of really wonderful tense scenes on the ship, including the point where the actual mutiny takes place during the midst of a fierce storm where it looks like the ship might be lost. Just tremendous movie, really powerful, and raises some interesting ethical questions as well.
Yes, great movie. I love the performance of Bogart in particular on this and the character he plays. I mean, wow, what an interesting character. Kind of creepy. Number five for me, Captain Horatio Hornblower. We did talk about Hornblower recently, the more recent TV movies, but this is the Gregory Peck movie from 1951, and it's a nice big budget, extravagant, swashbuckling kind of seafaring epic with lots of cannon explosions and everything going on. It looks beautiful. I mean, the special effects and everything, the model work just looks pretty great, especially for 1951. But a real exciting movie, and Gregory Peck's a great actor to watch, and he gets a lot of complexity into this Hornblower character at a later point in his life than the British miniseries covers. Great movie, good script, too.
Yeah, as much as I love those BBC Horatio Hornblower movies, you'd think I'd have watched this film, and I haven't. I really need to. Anyway, we've got a nice little theme going here, because I also have a sort of a swashbuckling type of film for my number five, and it was the more recent Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World from 2003 by director Peter Weir, starring Russell Crowe as Captain Jack Aubrey, another one of these guys from this series of books, which I haven't actually read, but man, I love this movie. It's so much fun, and I've been fond of saying that if the American public were smarter, we would have a trilogy of Master and Commander films versus a trilogy of crappy Pirates of the Caribbean films at this point in time, because, I mean, Master and Commander Far Side of the World actually ends on a cliffhanger, basically, and it doesn't look like we're ever going to see it resolved, but this is sort of in the old tradition of swashbuckling adventure movies. There's lots of great action, and it has a real kind of old-fashioned feel to it, even if maybe it's shot in a little more modern sense, and we get really frenetic action scenes, but such a good movie, and Russell Crowe does such a wonderful job here playing this character. Just such a fun movie. I like it so much. Some good dramatic parts, and I really like the central relationship between the captain and the ship's doctor, scientist, naturalist guy. Kind of an interesting thing to see. It's interesting seeing a big-budget movie that devotes so much time to sort of discussions of 19th-century scientific theory and that kind of thing, but just a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's the interesting, one of the interesting parts of the books as well, is that particular relationship. There's two great characters there. Well, for number four, see, when you picked the Caine Mutiny, you kind of picked two of mine in one. You had the Mutiny movie, and you had the Bogart movie, and I took two picks to do it. My Bogart movie is The African Queen from 1951, which is a kind of an adventure. It has Humphrey Bogart as this drunken captain, and Katharine Hepburn as the woman who's going to straighten him out so that they can both survive. But it's a neat little adventure movie, but really it's, again, a character movie about the clash of these two people and trying to get along with each other. If they cannot kill each other, then they might survive the external threats that they're under. But a really good adventure movie, and I like it quite a lot.
Yeah, I like it a lot, too. I don't think I like it as much as most people like it, but a cool movie, and it takes real good advantage of that real cramped space.
How can you not love, though, when Katharine Hepburn just takes the whiskey and dumps it overboard? I mean, there's some great character moments.
Yeah, there are some wonderful parts. Well, my number four pick is a movie that maybe not think of as a boat movie, but I love it so much, and a lot of it takes place on a boat, and that's Lady Eve from 1941 by director Preston Sturges, one of my favorite writer-directors out there, and I know one of Sam's as well. And the bulk of this movie, well, sort of maybe the first half of the film, centers around Barbara Stanwyck seducing Henry Fonda on this cruise ship, as he's this sort of nebbish professor who's coming back from living in the Amazon for some number of years, and he's got a bunch of money, and so she decides to go out and con him out of it by seducing him. And again, we have this great sense of this, sort of this closed environment. I think maybe a lot of these movies, we get the sense that you're on a boat. It's kind of a weird little world where you're all stuck for an extended period of time in this strange little enclosed place. And here we get a lot of that as well. And just this is probably Sturges' best film. I think most people would pick either this one or Sullivan's Travels as the best Sturges film. I think this one beats out Sullivan's Travels by a significant amount, but just funny and wonderful romantic comedy. The second half, not on a boat, but just as good, surprisingly enough.
It is surprising that part of a movie off a boat could possibly be as good as a part on a boat. I mean,
I know.
Yeah, well, that's weird. Number three for me is a movie called Mr. Roberts from 1955. Isn't it weird that so many of these movies are about tyrannical ship captains? But this is another one. James Cagney plays this tyrannical ship captain. This time they're, not in pirate days, though, or British expansionism or anything like that. It's World War II, much more recent in the South Pacific. Based on the author's experience, it was a novel first, then a play, then a movie, and the author based this story on his real-life experiences in the South Pacific on the USS Virgo. And that adds some authenticity, I guess, to it. This is sort of comedic, sort of dramatic. It delves a lot into the daily routine. It's not so much about the external quest and everything. It's about just living on a boat and getting along with the people who are there with you and get your job done. But, there's all these little things. It delves into the minutiae of this kind of lifestyle. And so, yeah, and great acting, too. I mentioned Cagney, Henry Fonda, William Powell, Jack Lemmon in a wonderful comic performance. And it's just a little slice of life kind of movie. I love it for that reason.
Yeah, and another one I haven't actually seen. My number three movie is the 1979 film by Francis Ford Coppola, Apocalypse Now, Never Get Off the Boat, based on Joseph Conrad's novel, Heart of Darkness, all about a boat trip. And this is actually, updates the setting from Africa to Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And we have Martin Sheen on this crazy boat trip down the river to go find the renegade Colonel Kurtz, played so memorably by Brando. And I think most people would agree that this is actually a film where once they get off the boat, it's not quite as good. The movie's kind of divided up into two parts, this long, crazy journey down the river to finally Kurtz's compound and then what goes on there. And I think most people prefer the crazy river trip to what they find when they actually meet up with Brando, though certainly that's all really memorable as well. But it does a good job sort of capturing that Heart of Darkness feel to it, this weird craziness that keeps creeping up and taking over as they get deeper and deeper into the jungle. And so many wonderful scenes. Hard to describe. I think Apocalypse Now is a really bizarre movie because it's become so entrenched in pop culture, but I think if you go back and look at it again, this is a really, really, really bizarre movie. I mean, virtually nothing that happens in it is kind of normal. It's all very sort of surreal and hyper-stylized, and it's pretty much the movie that drove Francis Ford Coppola completely insane, and he was never able to really make, I don't think, a real masterpiece after it, but worth watching, and great scenes on boats.
Yeah, okay, he's just off his rocker completely when, he's thinking about an ending. He doesn't have an ending for his movie Apocalypse Now, and what are we going to do for an ending? I don't know. I know. I'll chop up a cow, and that's his ending. Come on. I'm simplifying a little bit, but yeah, the movie does just go off the rails when it gets off the boat, and I'm pretty disappointed in it for that reason. I don't love it like a lot of people do, but things leading up to that, certainly terrific, especially individual scenes just taking alone are pretty brilliant. Number two for me, going back in time a bit, I mean, we get distracted, I think, by CGI and say, yeah, just look at the movies made 20 years ago or 10 years ago, and compared to today, we can do such visual wonders. And I think it gets forgotten that actually, if you go back far enough, like even to the 20s, you can find a lot of visual wonders that are just remarkable in their own right, and in some cases more because you know that it's not quite as much trickery involved. There are a lot of people really doing stunts that were really dangerous. I mean, in The Black Pirate from 1926, you got Douglas Fairbanks, who's at the top of the sails, and he plunges his knife into the sail and rides it down. Those are real stunts. And that's why I love The Seahawk from 1940, starring Errol Flynn, Douglas Fairbanks and Errol Flynn. I mean, you can do just either one of those, and you'll get a lot of spectacle and high adventure and exciting things. This movie, I swear, it just places the heroes in every conceivable predicament native to this genre without being cliched. It's kind of funny. And as an example of the visuals, is an early scene where these two ships are trading broadsides with each other, and there's men just swarming all over both ships. It's just very impressive. An exciting movie, lots of fun, and it's just, I don't think we get that today. Even Pirates of the Caribbean, which I like a lot more than Steven does, it's trying to recapture that and not quite making it.
Yeah, you know, I would agree. I do kind of like the older fashion styles to these sorts of movies. I think, actually, that the CGI in Pirates hurts the movie considerably, all three of them, because they go off in these crazy weirdness instead of just having good old-fashioned ship-to-ship combat. So, you know, I've talked about earlier how much I love those Horatio Hornblow movies from the BBC. I kind of like the low-budget aspect of it. There is no crazy CGI, and you get more stunts. And for some reason, sometimes that feels a little more real, even if it doesn't look as realistic. I'm not sure exactly why that would be. Well, my number two movie is practically the same as my number three movie. It's Aguirre, The Wrath of God by Werner Herzog from 1972, and it also kind of loosely follows the Heart of Darkness sort of setup. It's based on historical events, kind of, and you know, Herzog never one to shy away from taking liberties with real true history, but it's about a Spanish expedition down the Amazon that completely and totally ends in, well, I'm not even sure what, total madness, I suppose. And so you get that sort of sense. It was a very strong influence on Coppola when Coppola did Apocalypse Now. And Aguirre has all those real hallmarks of a great Herzog movie. I mean, it stars probably his favorite actor and, you know, one of his worst enemies, Klaus Kinski, who gives a just, if you want a guy to play just a complete and total madman, Kinski is a great pick for it. And here he does a wonderful job playing this Spanish conquistador who's going crazy as they go down this another just sort of surreal, insane journey. And much of it is just they have all these problems that they need to keep going. And, you know, even though it becomes obvious that they should turn back and their journey is doomed, Kinski's character continues pushing them ever forward. And sort of like also Apocalypse Now, there's lots of interesting and insane legends about the making of this film. I guess it was also an arduous shoot, and it comes through in the movie as well. So I'm not sure what it is about these boat movies that take us on crazy rides through rivers and jungles that just really speaks to me, but I really like that stuff. I'm not sure why that is.
Because it's on a boat, Stephen. It's on a boat, so it's a great movie. And also on a boat, and also a great movie, would be my number one choice, Lifeboat, from 1944 by director Alfred Hitchcock. Of course I'd pick an Alfred Hitchcock movie for my number one if I could, and here I can. Well, the idea is this ship has sunk by a German U-boat. So we're right in the middle of World War II here. The survivors climb onto this lifeboat, and they're all from people of different nationalities, and they're trying to get to know each other, and they're all a little suspicious of each other. And there's a German that is brought on board as one of the people who is rescued from drowning. And, well, who is he? People are pretty suspicious of him. It's a kind of a movie that, if it were made 10 years later, it would probably be interpreted as a commentary on McCarthyism, and maybe the script would have been tweaked a little bit so that it would be. But it's not quite that kind of movie, but it does touch upon the same ideas of suspicions and judging people on their backgrounds and not really getting to know them. But this movie is fascinating because it crowds everybody into this tiny space. They cannot escape from each other. They have to confront each other. They have to deal with the issues between them. And that just creates wonderful drama and suspense as well.
Yeah, a great movie. I kind of wish I would have thought of it. I would have put it on my list, but I actually had a lot more boat movies. You know, I don't know why. I had no trouble with boat movies. I had lots and lots of trouble coming up with movies for planes and trains, but I guess this just proves what you've been saying, that movies on boats are awesome. Well, my number one is my favorite Steven Spielberg movie. Well, gosh, I don't know about that. Pretty close to my favorite Steven Spielberg movie, and that's Jaws from 1975, which I think Sam only didn't pick on his list because I told him that I was absolutely taking it, and he couldn't because it was mine. I love Jaws. I've seen it a couple of times in the movie theater and you know, countless times on video. I watched it a lot as a kid growing up, and man, there's nothing better than this flick when it comes to great boat movies. That's my favorite boat scene of all time, where we have Schneider and Dreyfus and Robert Shaw all sort of talking about their various injuries related to boating and sharking in general, and sort of devolves into them drinking and singing Farewell to Spanish Ladies as suddenly the shark springs back to life and starts slamming into the side of their ship underwater, and you have that crazy great, just really, really suspenseful sequence where all we really are hearing are thuds as we know exactly what's going on. And so many wonderful, wonderful bits. I mean, we're going to need a bigger boat. Just so many great lines. This is everything that Spielberg is great at. His real big breakthrough, gigantic blockbuster film. There's something, in a sense, smaller about this film than a lot of Spielberg's later works. Again, the real set piece at the end is just this long, extended sequence of these three guys on this boat versus this shark. And we really feel the isolation and loneliness, and it adds to our terror. And it works really, really well. And I'm just a huge fan about Jaws. Can't say enough good things about it.
Yeah, I believe your exact words were, you can have Jaws when you pry it out of my cold, dead hand.
Yes.
I could have picked it as well, but it's more fun to talk about 12 different movies, and because, you know, that makes these ridiculously long segments even longer. Let's recap. Number 6, Mutiny on the Bounty from 1934, Captain Horatio Hornblower from 1951, The African Queen also from 51, Mr. Roberts from 55, The Seahawk from 1940, and Lifeboat from 1944. I got a bunch of old ones on mine this time, huh?
Well, that's surprising. Sam picked a bunch of older movies.
Yeah.
Well, he's just seen way more movies than most people should. My top 6, number 6, The Caine Mutiny from 1954 by Edward Dmytryk. Number 5, Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, 2003 by Peter Weir. Number 4, The Lady Eve, Preston Sturges' 1941 film. Number 3, Apocalypse Now by Francis Ford Coppola from 1979. Number 2, Aguirre, The Wrath of God by director Werner Herzog from 1972. And number 1, Show Me the Way to Go Home, Jaws, 1975 by Steven Spielberg.
One of the big expensive epics of the 50s and 60s was more expensive than it needed to be due to a series of mishaps with construction of the Roman slave ship featured in the film. The question is going to be, at the end of this, our trivia question for this week is going to be to identify the film. So I've given you a couple of clues. It's from the 50s or 60s. It's a big epic and it has a Roman slave ship in it. Well, anyway, an expert in Roman naval architecture was hired to design a slave ship for the movie, and he did. He submitted his designs to the studio, and one of the engineers at the studio said, "Hey, wait a minute, this thing is top-heavy. It'll sink." Well, the studio built it anyway, and sure enough, it rolled over in the water and sunk. So, anyway, they got the boat out, they put it in a pond, and anchored it into place with a bunch of cables to keep it from flipping over. And they used painted backdrops to convey the illusion that they were out at sea. So that's how they fixed that problem, with a bit of expense, I'm sure. Well, then it turned out that the color of the water was all wrong for what the open sea should look like. It wasn't blue enough. So they hired a guy to design a dye that they could dump into the water and turn it blue. So he did. And they dumped sacks of this blue powder into the water, but it didn't turn the water blue. Instead, it just made this thick, crusty stuff on the surface of the water, and it stuck to the boat and had to be chiseled off. So that's more expense. Well, finally, they did get a dye that worked, and, well, the problem then was one of the extras fell in the water, and his body turned blue and would not turn back to his normal skin color, so he was on the payroll at the studio for a while he recovered and got his skin color back to normal. So, more expense. So they film the outside scenes, and then they go to film inside the boat, and it turns out the cameras don't fit inside the boat. poor design plan there. So, well, they move the boat to a soundstage, they cut it open and film inside one of the halves of the boat, and that meant that the oars that the slaves had to row were just hanging out in the open air in the studio. It didn't look right because it wasn't pushing against the water. You could tell it was just a little too easy to move those things. So they got a bunch of the, you know, those piston kind of mechanisms that you see on the inside of screen doors that make them close but don't slam. They used a bunch of things like that to create some resistance on the oars, and so then when you pull the oar, it looked like it was you were having to work at it. So, you know, one expensive engineering failure after another. Well, what movie do you think this happened on? We're going to get to the answer at the end of the show, but think about what movie might have resulted in all this. Well, last week we talked about Alfred Hitchcock, a great director of entertaining thrillers, and this week we're going to go through his 54 movies, spending about 5 minutes on each one. So we'll start with The Lodger, Hitchcock's third film, actually. It's The Lodger. We skipped a couple, because he would have told you it's his first, because the other two just really aren't worth talking about. And right away we see Hitchcock thriving on the themes that he would return to for the next 50 years. Jack the Ripper is out there in London murdering women, blondes in particular, and there's a man, a lodger, who's just renting out an upstairs room from somebody who is suspected of the crime. Some great visual innovation here, some great audio innovation. And also in the film Blackmail from 1929, not quite Britain's first sound film, but close enough. We talked about these in our industry trend segments on sound, so I'll refer you back there and skip a lot of stuff here. I'm actually going to jump all the way up to The Man Who Knew Too Much from 1934, which was his kind of, in a way, a breakthrough film. I mean, The Lodger and Blackmail both were, but this was his biggest success to date, and some would argue it's his first real masterpiece. I wouldn't call it a masterpiece, though. I'd say it's his best film to date, but with reservations. I think it's got some pretty rough edges, but it does have a great performance from Peter Lorre, who, he learned his lines phonetically because he didn't know English. He was a German Jew who had just fled Germany and came to the UK. For me, though, Hitchcock's first real masterpiece was his next film, The 39 Steps, from 1935. It's a wonderful, wonderful escapist spy story with just one twist and one suspense sequence after another. A lot of set pieces and just interesting things. There's this guy with a photographic memory and a beautiful woman who turns out to be a spy being chased by assassins and disguises and chases, and the police are after everybody. That kind of movie. A whole lot of fun is the bottom line. I mean, there's not as much psychological depth as maybe Vertigo or something, but it's just such a well-put-together caper kind of yarn. I mean, a neat bit of escapism that moves along at a nice clip. Actually, you could put it in this terms, if you know the movie North by Northwest that he made much later, this is kind of the equivalent of that from the 30s. Fun movie. And so we'll move along to Sabotage, his next film, 1936. This is a more minor movie, but I want to mention it because it's a great example of how Hitchcock was still experimenting with the mechanics of thrillers. There's a suspense sequence in this movie that's almost unbearably tense. I mean, it's really tense, wherein a boy is carrying this package with a ticking bomb inside it. Now, I don't want to say what happens or how it fits into the story, the whole sequence in general, but it's interesting because this sequence works really well as a sequence, and yet Hitchcock later said he never should have filmed it. He said that part of the story would have been better to tell off-screen because being on-screen, it creates audience expectations it isn't able to follow through on in the context of the story. So it's worth watching the movie just to think about that scene and how Hitchcock was developing his style and finding out what works and what doesn't. But that's one to go back to after you've seen more of his movies. My favorite film from Hitchcock's British period, he worked in Britain until 1939, and my favorite film from that period was The Lady Vanishes from 38, right toward the end. And a great, great mystery. This couple meets an old woman on a train, and shortly after the train starts moving, she just disappears. I mean, she's not around. Nobody remembers ever seeing her, in fact, except the two main characters. And it's just a great ride watching these characters thinking up more and more innovative measures to try to get to the bottom of the mystery. And it's a wonderfully effective with its use of sound and also of silence. And I think we talked about this in our segment on sound as well. So anyway, Hitchcock's time in Britain comes to a close. He does make another movie, but it's not worth talking about. And we've actually skipped a lot of titles, maybe 24 titles already. But he moves to Hollywood and starts making films there for David O. Selznick, a very famous American producer. And their first collaboration is a highly successful movie called Rebecca from 1940. It won the Best Picture Oscar, in fact, although Hitchcock missed out on Best Director. He never did win a Director Oscar. And this is a great, dark, gothic romance, maybe a cross between Wuthering Heights and the film Laura. You got Joan Fontaine and Laurence Olivier contending with the dark secrets and the labyrinthine mansion and a spooky housekeeper and windswept bluffs and that kind of thing. It's just great. In particular, I absolutely love a sequence toward the end of the film where we're being told what happened once upon a time, and the camera pans between different places where those things once happened. And so all we're seeing is this empty place on the screen, but the mood and the narration is so evocative that you can just imagine these events perfectly, and the image you have in your head is of the characters doing the things that we're told they were doing, even though the image you get on the screen is of an empty room or empty place. Spooky kind of effect to it, actually. It's one of these rare situations where a movie is able to kind of use the strength of a novel, which is that we can imagine the events in our head instead of just being shown what they are. So an incredibly powerful sequence there. Behind the scenes, though, Selznick and Hitchcock just did not work well together. Hitchcock is a very controlling sort of director, that's important to say, because he didn't have a lot of patience for shooting on location or method acting or anything that he couldn't retain absolute control over. And Selznick was a very controlling sort of producer, so it stood to reason that they would clash on a lot of things. Especially back in the days under the studio system, producers tended to have a lot more control over the creative side of filmmaking than they do today, and Selznick loved to have a heavy hand in his film, so Hitchcock and Selznick didn't get along together, and Selznick wound up loaning Hitchcock out to other studios a lot just so he wouldn't have to work with him. Well, shortly after Rebecca, he made a movie called Foreign Correspondent, which is a great spy story with a lot of great set pieces, and like at this pilot's eye view of a plane crash in the water and a hill where there's a lot of windmills all turning in the wind, except for one that's turning in the wrong direction. Kind of a creepy, compelling image there. One visual innovation after another, showcase for great cinematography. And then the next year, he makes his only pure comedy called Mr. and Mrs. Smith, no relation to that recent action movie, but he didn't really like the job. He only did this movie as a favor to Carol Lombard, who's the star of the movie. He wasn't really comfortable with the screwball comedy type of thing, and that's what this is. And it's a pretty good comedy, too. It was funny that he made a good comedy that was well-timed, despite not really having his heart in this genre, but he was just a good filmmaker. It's also amusing, though, how he can't resist throwing some thriller elements into it anyway, even though it's not really called for. There's this moment where a couple of characters get stuck at the top of a Ferris wheel, and some comedy is supposed to come from the guy feeling woozy from the heights and so forth. Well, anybody else would just let the actor play it, but Hitch has to throw in these vertigo shots where everything's looking all dizzy and the lights are bright and everything, and that seals the deal. It's kind of funny how he works that way. So moving on to a movie called Suspicion. This is the first of five collaborations Hitchcock had with Cary Grant, and Hitch later said that Grant was the only actor he really loved. But he had a problem with him right off the bat, or at least the studio had a problem with Hitchcock's use of Grant, which was, hey, okay, Cary Grant at this time, this fine, upstanding gentleman image, everybody approved of him, you know, he was the guy you wanted your daughter to marry. You can't cast him as a character who is a liar, an embezzler, an adulterer, and potentially a murderer. And so the studio required a number of changes that Hitchcock always complained about thereafter to soften his image. But it is a good film, and there's some neat innovations in it, too, like when Grant is bringing up a glass of milk to his sick wife, and the milk may or may not be poisoned. There's actually a light inside the milk in the glass, and so it makes it glow kind of eerily. Neat effect to draw attention to the potential menace here. In 1942, we get the movie Saboteur, not to be confused with Sabotage, but it's another spy thriller. This time the big set piece is a fight on top of the Statue of Liberty, It's weird. Kind of today, it's hard to look at scenes like this and not think of them as horrible cliches. You know, you got an action thriller, and it builds up to a climactic battle on the top of some famous landmark. Well, Hitchcock was kind of a progenitor of this idea in the first place, so it's his imitators that turned it into the cliché. Way back in Blackmail in 1929, the climax is this chase across the roof of the British Museum in London, and at the end of North by Northwest, that was in 59, it takes place on Mount Rushmore. Well, here it's the Statue of Liberty, and it's a great, great ending. No music at all. Hitchcock was wonderful at knowing how to use music and when not to. It was rare at this time, actually, in cinema history for action not to be pumped up with music, and every dramatic beat and every moment action on the screen, not to be pumped up with a musical chord. And Hitchcock had a keen sense, really, for when not to do this. And so it's not done here at the climactic end, and I think it's all the more powerful for it. Because the action speaks for itself. Good special effects, too, actually. So let's move on to Shadow of a Doubt from 1943. Well, Stephen, you've seen this, right? Well, let me take a break, and I'll let you take this one.
Yeah, I have seen Shadow of a Doubt a couple of times, actually. It's a really, really good movie. I think we talked about it before when we talked about noir, but one of the most interesting things is its overall visual style. It's very, very interesting how this sort of serves as a bridge into the way the noir look, kind of making it its real inroads into mainstream Hollywood, sort of a bridge between the German expressionist films and the various gangster movies of the 30s into the films of the 40s. A lot of real high contrasting, beautiful black and white cinematography. And Hitchcock just, it's one of those things, I mean, how much was he actually influenced by those expressionist movies, and how much did he just really, really intuitively understand how to use light and shadow? The movie's all about Joseph Cotton as this uncle who comes to stay with his family in this small town. Everyone loves him and thinks he's a wonderful guy, except for his niece, who thinks something's wrong with the dude. And so many wonderful shots where Cotton is framed in darkness, and real wonderful shots where light is used to sort of establish the niece and set them off and set them apart. And I know, apart from that, it's also just a really great story, very suspenseful, really, really interesting. I saw it, I'd seen it before, and then I watched it again in a film class once we were discussing the history of film, and really, really watched it looking for the styles of the movie, its visual sense, and boy, it really, really comes across really well. Very, very interesting movie, just purely stylistically. Hitchcock always a master at style.
Yeah, he was, and I'm glad you mentioned light and shadow, because that's actually, as I remember it anyway, like the first thing I noticed about Hitchcock in terms of studying him rather than just simply enjoying the movies as entertainment is that he has a very particular use of light and shadow, very stark. And then when he got into color, he made similar use of color. He understood what colors to use when to create what moods and signal what things. But yeah, Shadow of a Doubt is a great movie for that in particular, but all throughout his career up to then and beyond, he was making a great use of light and shadow as well. I think that's a good point that you bring up. Did he just intuitively understand how to use these things, or was he influenced? I think it was much more of the former, because none of his movies really follow expressionism or noir strongly. It's not a pure noir or not a pure expressionism. It's a little different feel. I mean, it's a Hitchcockian feel. It's its own thing. So it's great to see a master using techniques that are established in other types of styles, but in the service of his own style. And that's also evident in his next movie, Lifeboat, from 1944, which is an adaptation of a John Steinbeck story about the survivors of a ship sinking after a U-boat bombs it. And the U-boat actually has problems too. It sinks as well. And there's a group of people crowded into this very confined place, one of which is a German survivor that people are pretty suspicious about. But, you know, a lot of the drama comes from the other characters debating about what they should do with the guy. A great film, which makes several great Hitchcock films in a row now. It's astonishing to think that he hadn't even hit his peak yet by this time. And the next one is Spellbound in 1945, an amnesia thriller. There's something about amnesia that is just really compelling as a plot device. You don't remember what's going on, but people are trying to kill you anyway. Well, this one is famous for a dream sequence designed by Salvador Dali, pretty creepy thing. And the next year he made Notorious. I'm going to hand it back to you because I know you got some comments about Notorious.
Yeah, I guess I have some comments about Notorious. You know, I don't think I like it quite as much as everyone else seems to. I sort of think it's a lower rung Hitchcock than most critics and scholars do. But still an interesting film. I like the fact that it's sort of a Nazi movie after World War II, right on the heels of World War II. That's kind of cool. But I think what it's most memorable for is the central love story. And it's got we got to talk about the wonderful scene where Hitchcock avoids the draconian rules of the motion picture production code that prohibited lengthy on-screen kisses. So he has Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman, who play the two romantic leads in this sort of weird spy espionage thriller. He has them embrace, and they're kind of kissing and kind of not. They're talking, and their faces are centimeters apart from one another. But technically, they're not kissing for too long at any given point. So he's able to nicely subvert the production code stricture against, what is it, something like overly passionate kissing or something like that. Some ridiculous rule that he couldn't have them kissing for more than X number of seconds at a time. So, but boy, I think Roger Ebert, in his one of his essays on this film, pointed out that it feels like they're kissing for 3 minutes or so. Wonderful long take, and I just love, great example of how Hitchcock was able to make all these dark, crazy movies within, you know, some of the strictest production code days. And this, the 40s and the 50s are really when it's at its peak, and you can't do anything that doesn't get approval from the Motion Picture Production Association, and yet he's still able to make all these dark, crazy, and sexually charged movies as well. By literally following the rules and completely ignoring their spirit, Hitchcock's able to slip this stuff in, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, it reminds me of Vertigo, actually. It was just a little bit later, and things were a little looser, but there's that 360-degree pan around a kissing couple, and very memorable scene. Another thing about Notorious is the ending. Now, Hitchcock is notorious for these action-packed endings, you know, fight on the Statue of Liberty, and, you know, nothing subtle about it, but Notorious is able to build that same kind of suspense by a couple characters walking down the stairs as people watch them. I mean, what an absolutely anti-intuitive kind of climax for a thriller, and yet just as effective, because it's all based on the context. In this movie, characters intersect in a lot of complicated ways, and so it's just a pretty explosive and delicate situation, the way, all right, this character has this concern about this other one, who has this other concern about this one, who has this concern about the first one, and it's kind of like a chess game in the end, where people are trying to try different moves to outmaneuver the other one. It's not just a, hey, can I chase the guy down a subway and catch him or not? That's a very simple kind of ending. So moving along, let's go to Rope from 1948, which is a interesting experiment because the film appears to play out in a single shot. Now, actually, that's not quite true. People say it is. There is at least one obvious cut in it. But by and large, the cuts, which take place about every 10 minutes, because that's about how much film you get in a reel of film, so you get it 10 minutes, but about every 10 minutes, the camera does some kind of trick, such as zooming in on the back of a guy, or some foreground object is placed in front of the camera, so that the screen goes dark, and then there's the hidden cut. You don't see the cut happen, and then the next take begins with that object being removed from the camera, and you see the rest of the action play. So, by and large, it just looks like a single cut, as if you were watching a play. And I think one of the effects, I think, is that things just feel a little bit more authentic, maybe. Because when you cut things together, you can make some pretty compelling things happen with cuts, and certainly Hitchcock did it. I mean, the psycho shower scene is made up of a lot of very quick cuts, and that's very effective. But by not cutting really visually much at all, he's able to just maybe convince you that much more that what you're seeing happen is really happening. It's not like you see a guy almost jump off a roof, and then there's a cut to him landing. You know that the stunt wasn't as dramatic as it is supposed to be, but, you know, in Rope, what you see is what you get. Although it is mostly a drawing room kind of talky mystery. I mean, there's a dead body hidden somewhere in the place, and there's a dinner party, and there's a lot of dialogue. But it is an interesting and probably great movie. Some pretty complicated moves, actually, too. Like, there's this moment where a character walks through a swinging door, and you see what he's doing on the other side of the door just because of the timing of the door swinging shut and then open again the other way, and you can see kind of a glimpse of what he was doing in that other room. So some neat, complicated moves like that. And he followed it up with a movie that also plays with these long takes, although not quite as obviously, and that's called Under Capricorn, which is a bit of an oddball. It's a costume drama. Hitchcock didn't really do those. Hitch worked almost always with the present day. Under Capricorn was a disappointment, actually, to audiences, because you got to understand, by now, Hitchcock has developed a huge reputation for himself as making these great audience-pleasing thrillers. They had very specific expectations about what they wanted out of a Hitchcock movie, and I think that if this movie hadn't come with Hitchcock's name on it, it would have been better received. Because it is a bit slower and more methodical and not as much of a signature thriller, but it is a good drama, and has a pretty compelling psychological angle to it. I'm not going to say it's a great movie alongside his other movies, but it is definitely worth seeing, as all his movies are. And we'll drop it there. We're going to pick it up next week with his movies starting in the 50s and moving on into the 60s. Don't miss out, because we haven't even hit the greatest Hitchcock movies yet.
We like to present public service to our listeners. You know, we're not all just fun and games around here. And so this is a little bit of a tutorial. Hopefully this will be a little educational segment for everybody, because I assume that everyone who's listening to this has some idea of how to use a computer, but do you have an idea how to use a computer in a movie? Because when you're stuck in the movie and you have to get something done on a computer, things are a little different than they are in real life. So I'm gonna teach you all about today, in today's how-to segment, all about how to use a computer with maximum efficiency, how to get things done quickly and efficiently, and how to deal with any kind of weird computer-related issues that will arise. So the first sort of basic things you have to know about how to use a computer is that environment really matters. Anyone who uses a computer really well has to have their workspace set up correctly. So, number one, you want everything to be dark, because lights make computers work less effectively, except for the blinking lights that are put all over all sorts of technological equipment. I mean, virtually every sophisticated electronic device has several blinking LEDs. The more blinking lights it has, the better it is, of course. But you don't want any kind of incandescent or fluorescent lights anywhere. You want your desk and workspace to be illuminated by just your monitor. And you want your monitor as bright as possible. In fact, ideally, you should be able to, someone, if you were, like, say, looking into a mirror while you're using your computer, you should be able to read text as the monitor projects it onto your face, because this is, all professional computer users have monitors that are capable of doing that. They're practically projectors. They're so bright. And, of course, if you're wearing glasses, you know, someone looking at you head-on should be able to see nothing but the reflection of the monitor in the glasses. By the way, glasses make you better at computers, so you probably want to have some just in case.
We should warn people, this will cost you money. I mean, if you want better technology, the brighter monitors and everything, you do have to shell out a bit more money, because that's why they make movies about these computers and not your dinky little thing at home.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It's just, if you've got
more expensive.
A dim monitor, I mean...
Yeah. The other thing you want to make sure you have is a lot of loud techno music, because if you want to turn your workplace into basically a rave, that's the right kind of attitude. That'll get you working more efficiently, and it'll help you start typing faster. As we see, you know, once you get that pounding house music, you'll be able to type really quickly, and typing quickly is really the key to using a computer, as we'll talk about in a second. Now, Sam also mentioned the kind of computer you have. You want it to look essentially as cool as possible, because the cooler looking a computer is, its case and stuff and monitor, the more powerful it is. No really powerful computers are sort of housed in plain beige boxes. They're always in slick, polished metal kind of cases with, like I mentioned, lots of blinking LEDs around and cool displays. So, you know, absolutely, at a bare minimum, you want to be using an Apple machine, because they have trippy looking designs. But even better is if you have some sort of, like, say, glass computer. Glass is great. It's very sleek. It goes faster. You can spray paint things on your computer, make it more distinguished, more personalized, that kind of thing.
I mean, nobody puts a Porsche engine in a Kia body.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, if it looks like a Porsche, you know what's under the hood.
Right.
That's the bottom line.
And, you know, much like cars, essentially, you want your computer to be as aerodynamic as possible so it can go faster. Maybe add some fins on there, too. I think it'd be pretty sleek.
Yeah.
You don't see many computers with fins. You also want as many monitors as you can crowd onto your desk. 4 or 5, if they're large, that's pretty good. If they're a little smaller, you want at least 10 or 15.
Yeah, that's more like it. I was laughing at like four. I remember when I had four monitors back in the 80s. I mean, those were the days.
Yeah. Heck, the best thing would be like a whole cluster, let's say, I don't know, a 5x5 or 6x6 square of just a wall of monitors that can all be looking at different screens. That'll really help you be more productive. Everyone knows the more monitors you have, the more productive you are. Now, there is an exception to this. If you can replace your monitor with a VR headset, a virtual reality headset, and some gloves to interact with it, that's even better. Or if you have some sort of holographic display, that will be completely and totally sweet and make you very, very effective. And your keyboard itself should be as loud as possible. You want those real strong springs that make that loud, clicky, buckly sound as you type. Because, again, typing fast, we're going to talk about, will be very important. And you can tell that you're typing fast because you're clicking loudly. Yeah, see, there you go. Just like that. Well, that's not loud enough, really.
No, it isn't, but it's the microphone. It's not the keyboard. Trust me, I have a loud keyboard.
If you had a louder keyboard, if you understood
what I just typed there, if you could hear it, that was me breaking into the government's website there.
Oh, watch out. Don't admit that. We're recording.
I mean, that was me breaking into my own bank account to see what the balance was.
There you go. That's much better. The operating system you use, you don't want to use this kind of nonsensical like Windows or Macintosh or Linux operating systems. Those are all boring and ineffective. I mean, they're for consumers and not for guys who are, you know, super users. So you want really some 3D effects. That's going to be ideal. You want to be able to navigate your operating system in three dimensions. Except for most of what you're going to do is going to be what they call the command line interface, especially if you're a hacker, because all of your, you know, real elite hacking is going to be done by typing a lot of text. But you all, in order to like say launch your terminal window, you better have a cool 3D method of accessing the button that opens it up. So, you know, that's how you're really going to do all your stuff and say do complicated things like breaking, you know, encryption. You're going to definitely need to do all that in 3D. This is why a VR headset is so good with the gloves as well.
The real advantage to hacking with the VR, I mean, I'm a command line person myself, but there is one thing, and that is where you can see when you're trying to hack into the CPU, you can see where the viruses are, and you know where to shoot.
Oh, yeah. The other important thing, too, about the VR headset and gloves is that you can replace the keyboard with an on-screen virtual keyboard and just type on that, because I assume that when we all switch to VR interfaces, primarily we'll still be typing on imaginary keyboards in the air with our VR gloves. I mean, that'll be great, and hopefully we'll have some speakers in our headset that makes a really loud click every time we touch a fake key. Okay, so to actually use the computer and let you everything set up, if you're not typing, you ain't using it. I mean, despite your super cool 3D interface, nobody does anything important with a mouse. So anyone who can use a computer well types at about 200, 250 words per minute. That's essentially kind of a baseline. If you can get up above 400, you're really, really going well. So, like, I mean, Sam demonstrated that whole clicky, clicky, click, clack, clickety, clack. That's really ideal. You want to be as... I mean, my keyboard's way too quiet. This is an unpowerful machine, but you know, the louder you get it, faster you get it, that's good. The faster, the better. And, okay, so you got a couple different tasks you want to do on a computer. Let's say you want to create a file. Well, the first thing to do to create files well is, of course, to type faster. And we should also know that when you have to save or download something, it's excruciatingly slow. It pretty much takes the same amount of time to save or download, regardless of the file size. This is a common misconception people have. They think, you know, smaller files can be written faster. Nope, not true. It'd always be excruciatingly slow. The nice thing is if you have some sort of deadline, let's say someone's going to walk in the room and kill you if you don't escape in 30 seconds, you'll be able to get out of there in exactly 29 seconds. There's this strange way that the amount of time it takes to save something or download something is directly related to how much time you have. So if you want to speed things up, you know, hire someone to come into your room and kill you in 30 seconds. That way it'll only take you 28 and a half. Makes it much faster.
Yeah, I mean, it's logical. For example, write a letter, you know, the old-fashioned way, in paper, put it in the mailbox, one page, you know, write a second letter, make it 12 pages. Send that to the same person at the same time. Is the one-page letter going to get there 12 times faster? I don't think so. I mean, it's really weird how people have those strange misconceptions. It's just, it's logical.
Exactly. They just don't understand computers.
One message, one email, one file, whatever, that determines is how many files.
Exactly.
And that's why zip works, because you're taking a whole bunch of files, combining it into one file, so you can send it faster.
Precisely, that's exactly right. Now, so that's writing files. What about deleting files? Well, it's pretty silly. I don't know why I have to explain this to you. Either you press delete or type delete, or you just move it into the trash can, and that's pretty much it. This will actually delete everything. A lot of people don't realize that you can delete information stored on already written CD-ROMs or DVDs this way. Just go ahead and press delete. But you need to know, everything can always be undeleted. It is physically impossible to ever prevent information from being recovered once it's entered into a computer. There's nothing you can do, no magic thing you can do. It's just that's just the way it is. So when you want to recover files that somebody else has deleted, you can always do this. Run the undelete command or the equivalent on your operating system. Maybe get your VR headset and go into the file itself and find the bad sectors and uncorrupt them. Maybe you only have to shoot the viruses or whatever, depending on what it's caused. Sometimes you'll uncover just part of a file that was deleted, so like you'll see like some of the text and the rest of it will be weird numbers and stuff. You can easily use simple image enhancement or file enhancement software through your 3D interface to repair information that's missing. As long as you have just a slight part of a file, you can always extrapolate everything else that was there, and sometimes stuff that wasn't. That's how computers work. Some other tasks people like to do. Encrypting files. This is a real waste of time and CPU power. All encryption can be easily broken by anyone with a decent desktop system and, you know, a 14-year-old's knowledge of how computers work. Even some 12-year-olds, I think, can handle this. If you have a 3D VR interface, it's even easier and faster, but, I mean, at the end of the day, everyone can break encryption really, really easily. I don't know why people waste their time with it. It's just to make themselves feel better, honestly, so don't worry about that. And I wouldn't waste my time encrypting things, and if you need to unencrypt something, it's no problem. To find information, all you ever have to do is just type the information that you're looking for into the search box and click OK. You will always find what you're looking for in the first entry, really, just the number one entry in the results list will always be precisely what you're looking for. You know, if you're like looking for somebody named Bob Jones, right, you just put him into the search engine, hit enter, and it will come up with the exact correct Bob Jones you're looking for. The search technology is very good today. That's precisely how it works. So just make sure you type exactly what you're looking for and hit enter. And it can also be used to find files and stuff on a system, too. I mean, most operating systems have a single search prompt that searches every single thing on the computer and all the databases, that kind of thing.
By the way, don't ever make... You said don't encrypt anything.
Yeah.
Don't make anything secret.
Oh, yeah.
Whether this is like naming it secret files or putting it in some hidden directory because...
Waste of time.
What's the first thing a hacker's going to do when he gets on your system? He's going to type access the secret files,
yep.
And your computer will give them the secret file.
Exactly.
It's just like put it in a box called, here, hacker, look at this, probably miss it. So that might be a better idea.
You know, speaking of hackers, that's sort of the last thing I want to cover. Hacking is an important skill in movies. So if you're going to hack a computer, there's a couple things you need to keep in mind. It's not that hard, by the way, but just, you know, some precautions. First and foremost, route your signal all over the place through lots of other hacked systems and satellites. I'm sure your operating system has a simple hacking utility that'll let you bring up a map of the world where you can just go ahead and click around all the different places to route you through. This will make it take much longer when the feds are tracing you. So like every system that you route it through gives you another 30 seconds to a minute, depending on how good of a hacker you are. When you're trying to break into a system, commonly used passwords systems administrators use are things like God or open or password, maybe the person's name or the person's social security number or their birthday or the birthday of their daughter or something. I mean, this is pretty much always the case. Lots of passwords, in fact, are commonly just strings of digits. This is very common. So if you just know what digits are important to that person, you know, it'll be about 5 to 8 digits. You just type it in, you're good to go. So just do a little bit of research.
If you run up against a clever system administrator, they might try to mix up one of these words. So try, here's the thing, try typing password backwards, and that will get you into most of the systems of the clever system administrators.
Yeah, also common are people who are trying to be a little bit sneakier. You know, if you're trying to find some information on Project Omega, often the password will be something like Omega. So just keep that in mind as well. When it prompts you to, you know, the password for these secret files, type in Omega.
If you really can't get it, though, to have a conversation with the system administrator or whoever you're confronting, just have a little showdown, because they'll probably give you a hint.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're not thinking backwards enough. And there you go.
Now, if for some reason you can't have a conversation with the network administrator, you can easily use a free downloadable programs to break passwords quickly and easily. These programs just run through a list of all possible words in a couple of minutes. And, of course, these ones also, though, tend to take precisely the amount of time that you have available to you. So if you have 10 minutes before the FBI gets your signal, you're going to take 9.5 minutes to break the password or crack through the encryption or whatever. So just keep that in mind. Be sure that you're in a hurry and it'll go faster. Okay, now, that's hacking, but what about getting hacked? You know, there's no easy way to prevent yourself from getting hacked. In fact, the only thing you can do is to out-hack the other guy. Be a better hacker. If you're being hacked and they're shooting the viruses at your CPU, there's really nothing that you can do about it except to out-hack them. Foolish people will try turning off their computer or unplugging the network cable. Don't waste your time with that. Do you really think hackers who are good are going to be limited by no network connection? Now, they'll get through it easily. And this is something to keep in mind, too, when you're hacking. Every computer everywhere is on a network that you can easily get access to, including important bank computers or Department of Defense computers. I'm sure, you know, the computers inside of tanks, you know, the military tanks are also controlled through the internet, that kind of thing. So you can hack really anything you want to. So just remember, be a better hacker and you will not get hacked yourself.
Okay, now I have a question here.
Okay.
This is something that I encounter a lot of times, and I think we can give out an additional tip here. People run into this too. Sometimes when, you know, like going back to accessing the secret files, it says that permission is denied and I'm not authorized. You know, I'm not authorized to access this. What do I do then?
That's when you need to know the secret password. Just go and hack it, and then you log in as the system administrator whatever.
Okay, well, what I'm saying is I think you should check to see if there's an override first.
Oh, that's true. A lot of systems do have overrides.
Because I think there's usually an override, and you can just...
Yeah, so check around for overrides or backdoors. A lot of times, if you just enter some secret key command into the system, it will automatically give you, you know, super access. That's a common thing to do as well.
And, you know, when in doubt, just ask the computer for help because,
oh, absolutely.
I mean, they understand English and they got nothing better to do.
You know? You can also, you know what else will often work is just pressing the escape key. That'll go ahead and make everything.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's sort of your last resort. You don't know what it's going to do. It might shut down the system or it might very well just go ahead and override the security protection. So I think when all else fails, press escape and hope for the best.
It's time for the answer to our trivia question from earlier on. I won't repeat it. It's pretty long, but it's a good story, so if you skipped ahead, we'll go back and listen to that part. But, Stephen, what movie do you think this happened on?
I'm going to guess Ben-Hur.
You are absolutely correct, yes. Ben-Hur. So when you see the slave ship scenes and that, you can think about what terrible things happened to bring those to the screen. Another big famous sequence in that movie, of course, is the chariot race. Extremely dangerous to film. There is an urban legend that a stunt driver was killed during the filming of it, but this wasn't true. There weren't any serious injuries, actually, in the filming of that. The most common injury was sunburn.
That wraps up things for episode 45, but we'll be back next week, and we're also here 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on the website, allmovietalk.com. Please, please, please don't hack us. I know I've just explained to you how you could very easily. Please be a good guy. Don't do it.
And check back with us next week. See, if you hack us, you can't do this. But, yeah, check back with us next week. We'll have another episode. It's pretty exciting. We're going to wrap up our talk about Hitchcock and also start a talk about the history of editing. And our top six next week is going to be the top six plot holes in good or great movies. Think about some great movies that still have plot holes in them. Kind of an interesting and fun topic. So we'll talk about that next week on August 14th on All Movie Talk.
I don't care what any computer program says. I'm doing it this week. I don't care. No. I'm doing it. I'm doing it right now. Cut!